University, the voice of Reichman University.
And the reason is very interesting, I think. Most animals know how to parent, right? So most animals, when you look at a dog, it gives birth to some puppies, yeah. And a dog just knows what to do. In fact, most animals know what to do when they give birth. Humans are a very interesting example. We do not have innate knowledge. No. The knowledge of how to parent, yeah. of how to be a mother, is culturally transmitted. We have to learn it. We have to see it from our mothers, from our sisters, from our today from books
and TikTok.
And TikTok, of course.
Take tips from TikTok.
I learn everything after
Right. So learning culturally transmitted knowledge on how to be a parent is very special. And elephants are like us.
Actually, serious. Amazing conversations from Israel, all topics considered, with Aaron Porras and Hannah Rifkin.
Welcome to the Actually Serious podcast, where we cover Israel's most interesting with all topics and the wonderful humans behind them considered. We're brought to you in partnership with Audioversity and No Camels, the leading site for Israel innovation news.
And of course, before we get into it, as always, remember to subscribe to the podcast on Audioversity, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, anywhere you get your podcasts, and social media and YouTube at Aaron Porras. Like, comment, and hit the notification bell as well while you're at it, so you can be sure to hear about any of our new content. Sure. I'm Hannah Rifkin.
And I'm Aaron Porras. And today, we're here with Limor Aviv, Minerva Research Group Leader, leading the Language Evolution and Adaptation in Diverse Situations, or LEADS Group.
I know.
That's a mouthful.
I know.
At the Max Planck Institute for Psycholinguistics. I love this title. And part-time lecturer at Social Interaction at the Center for Social Cognitive and Effective Neuroscience, or CSCAN, at the University of Glasgow.
Yeah.
Which is very cool.
Thank you.
We're gonna have to hear about that. How are you?
I'm great. I'm excited to be here. Thank you.
So it's our pleasure. And actually, in preparation for this interview, I spoke with a couple of my friends from out of town who happened to be visiting. And I asked them, you know, this is this person's pedigree. This is this person's title. What are some of the questions you want to ask? And I got some good ones. What's your sign?
what a classic one.
Yeah. What's your favorite sandwich? Do you think a hot dog is a sandwich?
Hmm.
And what's up with elephants? Like, what's their deal?
I know. Wow, great questions.
So if you want to take them in whatever order you see
some
fit.
Some of them are more relevant than others, but they're still fun questions.
Right. Sounds like, all right, I'll get the silly ones out of the... So I'm a Libra. I don't think
wow, that explains everything.
Yeah. Thank you.
Can now I go, we know
can I
everything
go now?
About you. We're done.
All right. Yeah. So that's that. Favorite sandwich. I'm a vegan, so I'm not really interesting. Vegan tuna.
Vegan tuna.
For real, though.
What is that made out of?
I don't want to know.
Good answer. That's what I would say.
Don't ask questions you don't want to know the answer to.
I know. Yeah. What was hot dog?
Is a hot dog a sandwich?
Well... It's a bread with something in it, so I...
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to influence your
I tried, I really tried.
Context is everything.
I guess.
Yeah.
All right, and what is, like, what's elephants' deal? Like, what's their problem?
Oh my God, they're amazing. So elephants are, they're a favorite of mine. So I ended up working on language evolution, which has nothing to do with elephants. And
yet apparently everything to do with elephants.
I know. So over the years, I've been trying to kind of like see how I can kind of venture off a little bit to animal communication. And I ended up working a little bit on elephants. And that is actually one of my biggest prides. So I have a paper on elephants.
Yeah.
I'm super proud.
Which I didn't understand any of it.
Aw. But that's why you're here today.
Yeah. Fair enough.
To break it all down.
Yeah. I mean, I understand. Okay. So my problem is I don't know. I have to understand.
His problem is he's dim.
Yeah, I have to look up like all of the words that you used individually in this research paper's abstract. I mean, you're talking about like self-domestication of animals. You're talking about their cultural linguistics and how they communicate with one another. I mean, it's not necessarily in a language like you or I speak. But that in and of itself, I mean, that's a very surface level understanding of what you've done. And that's about as deep as I go. So I'd love for you to expand.
Well, that's why I'm here, right?
Yeah.
All right. So maybe some background.
Yes.
Before this. So I'm interested in language and how do languages evolve and why do humans speak, and use, not just speak, we also sign, but why do humans kind of have the languages they do? Our languages are really unparalleled in nature. When you look all around you, all animals communicate, right? And they communicate in sophisticated ways and they pass information and they have even words for specific things. We already know that some primates have words for eagle or words for tiger. And actually,
I did not know that.
Yeah. So the way they find these things out is with playback experiments. So they record different types of calls and then they play them back and they see what do the primates do. And a lot of the times you see the different calls elicit completely different responses. So in that specific experiment, it was like they found out it was an eagle because when they played that sound, all the kind of apes looked up and then ran down to hide under bushes. And when
do these different groups of primates within the same species have different like accents and you know what I mean? Like,
oh my god!
Because, no, I mean because like if you play that same sound to an animal in a zoo from thousands of miles away who maybe even grew up in captivity, will it still understand eagle?
So that's a very good question. It depends on the animal. In fact, most primates have their vocalizations are actually rather innate. So if you take baboons, for example, and you listen to baboons in, I don't know, in Africa, and you then go to a zoo in Europe, you will hear the same calls. Wow. So that's not the culturally transmitted part or the kind of diverse part. It's more the gestures. That's actually really interesting. So different Ooh. Groups tend to have more like sign language, if you think about it.
Wow.
So vocalizations are indeed kind of restricted. We don't see this kind of cultural diversity. But all animals communicate, right? And they communicate about very interesting things.
And they intercommunicate between species, right?
Also, yeah. But and I mean, we do that too. But it is interesting to kind of think about the similarities, but also the differences, because human language is really has this kind of unparalleled expressive power. We can talk about anything with everyone. Yeah.
We have like abstract words.
Yeah. And I'm gonna say this with kind of a bit of humbleness, because we don't actually know all the things that animals communicate about, sure. because we try to analyze their speech or their gestures based on what we think is necessary or what we think is relevant. But we don't always hear everything. We don't always. So I don't know if a mouse twitches their ear, we might not think about that as communication, but maybe it's saying right. something really important. So we don't
saying,
know.
Saying, I love your fur today. Like, you know, what's good?
Yeah. Same for whale song, by the way. So we recorded whale song. It sounds really elaborate. We have no idea what it is.
With whales, I think I heard that they do have different accents, like different kind of.
Yeah, they do. They do. They have different songs, and they actually you can see that songs kind of travel through the oceans as groups meet.
So
it's
wild.
Pretty cool.
So cool.
But we talk about. It seems like our languages are special. Mm. And what I do is try to answer two questions. One is, why do we have the languages we have? So how do they evolve to begin with? And the second is, why do we have so many of them? So why are there so many different languages in the world, so many dialects, so many accents, so many vocabulary, so many grammatical structures? I mean, if you think of language as a tool for communication, it might seem very reasonable that we should all speak the same language. That would Right. be... That would be great, right? That would be very useful.
It'd be super useful.
but that's clearly not the case. There are about 7,000 different languages in the world today, over 200 signed languages. So there's a lot of diversity, and perhaps even more if you look back in the past. Now we have these kind of global languages. And,
We have, I mean, like how many languages that were ever spoken are, you know, we have no idea.
Yeah, we have no idea.
Right.
Yeah. So that's an interesting question. Even if you and if you think about languages, because they're constantly changing, that kind of endeavor would be futile. So even if you were to kind of, I don't know, let's create a language that everyone would speak and you would teach that to the entire world, great. But then one group would go and, you know, live over there and another
change in like three years.
For sure.
Yeah, definitely within a few generations. You can actually see this with Hebrew, for example, mm-hmm. which is a new language you really tried, and then, you know, language in three generations already changing quite a lot.
Yeah.
So Yeah, so those are the kind of questions I'm interested in. So not elephants, but human language. And the reason I kind of got excited about elephants is actually because of a different theory that tries to explain why did language evolve in humans. And that theory is called the human self-domestication theory, which is a big name and it doesn't mean a lot.
We're going to need to break that down.
Yeah, let's unpack this for a little bit. All right, so I think the term is very misleading. And quite confusing. So I'm going to try to use it as little as possible and then kind of walk you through the more the story. So how did people come up with this idea? So what happened is that humans domesticated a lot of animals, right? We domesticated sheep and dog and even fish. And the way we did this is by over many, many generations selecting selecting with breeding, but also just kind of implicitly selecting for animals that are kind of more tamed and more and less aggressive. So it's actually a selection for reduced aggression. Right. I don't know if you think of dogs, maybe there were some dogs kind of scavenging.
We took the one that was nicest and we let him live.
it's even that those that were kind of nicer were able to get a little bit closer to us, and then maybe they got a little bit more food, and those that were really aggressive, maybe we killed them because they were aggressive. We didn't want them near us. And over time, that kind of minor selection grew to the point where we are breeding, artificially breeding.
I remember hearing there was like some research where he found it was like seven generations and he had like a totally domesticated version of a fox or something like that.
That's a very famous experiment. So the silver fox experiment, I think was it in Russia? They tried to do kind of a controlled experiment of domestication, took some wild foxes and then just slowly over time to put the hand in their cage. And those who didn't bite, at the beginning it was those who didn't bite that got bred. Mm-hmm. Later it was those who were approaching the hand. Within seven, actually, I think more like 10 generations, they get
which
these
for
foxes
a fox
who are
is
like,
still not that long.
No, like, who are like all cuddly with humans and
but
want
they,
attention.
They physically they looked physically different as well, though.
Right.
It was like, I mean, they were fluffier. They had more like, you know, those baby cutesy attributes. It was,
exactly. So what we found out with this experiment is that when we select for reduced aggression, there's kind of a bunch of other traits that kind of happen automatically. These are things like more pigmentation, floppy ears, more social behavior, more playful behavior, an extended juvenile period. That means that pups stay pups for longer. Very interesting things, a change in their skull, so their face got smaller, their teeth got smaller. So there's a bunch of these kind of traits that happen automatically. We didn't select for...
But does that mean... That probably means that they wouldn't make it in the wild. I mean, they're weaker. They're softer creatures.
Yeah. So Darwin said something about, you know, survival of the fittest and domestication and self-domestication. It's about the survival of the friendliest. It's actually a complete shift in perspective.
Yeah.
So
is it because like, because when you're talking about fitness though in the Darwinian language, I mean, it's not necessarily like the most physically fit. It's the one who is the best adapted for the environment it's in.
Yeah.
Right.
So, I mean, I think it would still apply, technically.
So that's domestication. Domestication is a really interesting phenomenon where we kind of change a species to better fit us, our needs, be it as a pet or a beast of burden or food, right? So we domesticated a bunch of animals for different reasons. We domesticated sheep and horses and dogs.
Is this why you're vegan?
No, actually not.
Okay.
No. But anyway, so this domestication, you're right on the money. So it created a bunch of other traits that we didn't select for. And those are called the domestication syndrome. And it's just a list of like, I don't know, 20 or 30 physical features. Some of them are actually molecular, like increase in cortisol levels or very different weird things that we just kind of happen by default as a byproduct of selecting for reduced aggression. And we notice that these happen all over domesticated animals. So if you look across very different clades, very different taxa, so from fish to sheep, you see that all the animals we domesticated seem to have quite a lot of these traits. So that was the story. But then came a few kind of smart researchers and were actually looking at humans and said, whoa, humans also show a bunch of traits from the domestication syndrome. We also have a reduced skull, reduced teeth, extended juvenile period. We don't have floppy ears because
maybe compared to what we had before.
Good point.
Because what is this?
Fair enough. Fair enough. I kind of floppy earlobe. Right? Great. No, curly tail, clearly.
I'm telling you. Is there a place at Max Planck for me?
you can come.
Yes, I did it.
Right. So that was kind of a very interesting observation that human also show the domestication syndrome. And that got a bunch of people thinking, because if the domestication syndrome is a byproduct of having kind of a process that made this species less aggressive and more pro-social, then maybe humans also went through a similar evolutionary process. Wow. We weren't domesticated by any other species. So maybe it's kind of an organic self-inflicting process, hence the name self.
Sure. Well, it makes a lot of sense just because we've gone from civilization where we were hunter-gatherers and we spent all our time outside and it was all about survival, to wearing shoes and trying to be civilized and eating at a table with a fork and a knife. So it makes sense.
Interestingly, it's even older than this. So the story of the kind of human self-domestication is actually an evolutionary ancient story, in the sense that even when we were hunter-gatherers, we were probably already very, very pro-social towards each other. So I just want to say with a grain of salt, I mean, humans are also very aggressive. Right. We're aggressive, but mostly to our out-group. So yeah. The story of domestication is a story of a reduced reactive aggression. That means that when I get mad, I don't just like go around and smack people. And so I can control my emotion. I have this kind
awareness.
Of, yeah, an inhibition, right? Yeah. So we're able to control our emotions. And also we're very, very, very friendly to our kin and our kind of close in-group community. When it's an out-group, then we're, you know, then we can be very...
Yeah, I mean, screw those guys.
Yeah, but even then, if you think about it, the kind of aggression that we inflict, think about wars, think about the war in Russia. It's actually, you need cooperation in the millions to have that kind of war launched. So we're very aggressive, but in a very pro-social, premeditated way. It's really weird. We don't just go around and like, you know, kill people.
But I think ultimately though, I think we do tend towards cooperation as a
yes.
trait.
Yes. Yes.
But it would make sense how our features have changed, just because we don't need all, like, the things that we eat differently. We don't just like scavenge raw meat. We cook you know what I mean? Like, it makes sense that like that over time our bodies would change and
Yeah. So the kind of creation, the discovery of cooking is definitely a big thing in human evolution, and goes way before Homo sapiens. So there are theories that actually, you know, definitely Neanderthals cooked, but also maybe Homo erectus. And as you go back in the kind of Homo lineage, cooking and control of fire is something that we can trace back to at least a million years ago. So that's way before, but it's way before Homo sapiens.
Right.
Homo sapiens is a species about 200,000 years old, depending on how you date it.
Yeah.
So our kind of ancestors were already this kind of more intelligent species that had tools. And potentially even clothes. Maybe not our nice sneakers, but maybe this like piece of leather kind of just covering our
I feel like that would be so annoying to walk over rocks with that.
I feel like we're going back towards that, like, in a lot of styles.
It's like hippie barefoot culture.
There's a guy on campus who walks around without shoes.
Yeah.
Just all the time.
My partner walks around without shoes. It's a thing. Yeah. Yeah. Well, he's a physiotherapist, and he would say that it's just much healthier, much better for
you. It is. I've always gotten very wide shoes. I find them more comfortable. And now I see that there are several brands that are deliberately marketing that as like, it's better for your feet. We have a very wide toe box in the shoe. Like, this is what we do.
They're targeted.
Have you ever seen like old people with like mangled feet that like go inward?
Yeah, and they're their finger knuckles are like crossed over. It's awful.
So basically, you're the target audience is hobbits.
Is hobbits and me.
The hint was that you're a hobbit.
I mean, I'm a little taller, but the hairy feet and the eating five breakfasts, you know, they got me there.
Yeah, brilliant.
I think it's very interesting what you said about people, I guess, being, I mean, we know this, that people are less friendly to their out group, but language and the way we communicate, I mean, you always hear about you never truly know a language until you fully understand its culture. And maybe that's why it is so, I guess, difficult for everyone to get along, because this means something different in Italy than it means somewhere else, you know? So,
yeah.
Like, how can you, like, people, the way people think is just different.
Yeah, so language is not just for communication, it's also for social signaling, right? So when we speak different languages, we also, that's also a social signal. That means I'm from a different group as you. Mm-hmm. So it's true that our kind of language group today ends up actually defining a lot of our in-group. So, and if you think about, I don't know, people in the US, you feel like this one
you gravitate towards the people who speak the same as you. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like even in bi and trilingual groups. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Exactly. So language is a social marker as well. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just used for pro-sociality or for socializing. It also kind of dictates the way who we talk to and how. And that's also why learning a second language, if you think about it, it's a whole thing. It comes with, you know, sort of difficulties. And you know that you never, how do you know if somebody speaks a second language to kind of a native-like level as whether they kind of have good control of all these not really linguistic cues, even things like in English, like. So if you think of the word like.
The filler words.
The filler words. Yeah, which are actually very, there's a lot of linguistic theory behind them. They do a lot of heavy lifting in language. We treat them kind of like, ugh, like it's this.
Oh, and yeah, and I have this. Speech teachers telling me stop using filler words.
But you can tell who's a native speaker because they're so casual with how they talk.
Yeah, right. And they do have rules. So you can't say like in any point in the sentence. I can't say things like, 1 + 1 is 2, like.
Yeah.
1 + 1 is like 2. That means I'm not sure. That's a marker for confidence or a marker for, whether what I, do I believe what I'm saying? Yeah. Am I sure about it? So it has a lot of, Wow. I don't know how we got to talk about this.
You were telling us about elephants and then we got distracted.
What is the elephant's filler word?
Fair enough. It's this trumpet. No. Right. So the self-domestication theory, a very interesting theory that suggests that humans, the reason we are the way we are is because we've been through a process that made us more pro-social and less aggressive. And it's a theory, right? It's not, we don't know today if it's, you know, the right one. But it's an interesting theory because it makes interesting predictions about humans and the way we behave and also kind of our genetics and our, so maybe we should see markers that seem more like, so domestication also acts on our genes. So maybe we can see those kind of traits and kind of markers in humans, and we often do, so that's very interesting. Wow. And that theory was recently, like, I don't know, 10 years ago, people also started suggesting that self-domestication could have also been a trigger for languages to evolve. So the idea is that as we become more social, as all animals communicate clearly, but as we become more social and as our social group grew, so rather than just talking to our closest family, we also started being more social towards strangers and people, non-kin. And that means that you have to develop a language that's slightly perhaps more sophisticated or more more transparent, because we don't have shared history and shared context with people who we don't know. So the language needed to become a little bit more sophisticated. And as the language has become more sophisticated, that allows for even more social behavior. And that more social behavior allows for...
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a real chicken and egg situation to a degree.
It's called a feedback loop in genetics.
Right.
So it's a positive feedback loop where a small change in trait X allows for a small increase in Y. And kind of.
So can we apply this predictively towards the future now?
We can. You wanna try?
Yes, I do. So tell me about the fall of Western civilization.
Actually, I think if you take this theory seriously, it predicts exactly the opposite. So it predicts that humans in group is growing. And if you look at it, again, it's from, I'm an optimist, right? So I believe in humanity and, you know, kind of everybody social and good at heart.
This is biased research.
Right. But all research is biased. It's done by people. But I believe that if you look at what's happening in the world today, mm-hmm. you see that people's in-group is growing. It used to be just your village. Now, you know, and then, I don't know, a few hundreds of years ago, it was your the empire. So you feel like you're one with, I don't know, the empire that you're at. Now, it could be a whole continent, right? So now Europeans, despite being, you know, in different countries, they're still, you know, there's the European Union. It's this like one thing that they're all a part of. Same for the US. And slowly, I think we see this kind of human unification to thinking that our in-group is all of humanity, right? So we act together in many places of the world. As if you look at kind of Western civilization, that civilization starts seeing everybody else as a part of our in-group. We want to act for humanity. We spend millions of euros to support people in Africa, even though we never seen them and we live very far away from them.
Probably will never see them. Yeah.
Right. So that's, and I would say as a vegan, interesting. I think our in-group is even slowly expanding to become not just all of humanity, but all of life. So now if you talk to a vegetarian, sure. they're acting to kind of, you know, make life better also for animals around them. This is unprecedented right. in human history. It's not, we never used to care, not about a person who lived in the other side of the country.
Noah, right. biblical Noah, he cared.
Well, God told him to do it.
Yeah.
Oh, fair.
Yeah. yeah.
Fair. And it was very selfish, right? Isn't it? Yeah. Right. So now not only do we care about strangers and we feel close to strangers, we can feel close to people, to animals that are not people, right? So I think if you take that prediction seriously, I think we're actually headed towards a more pro-social and more peaceful world. And sure. if you look at, and again, I'm an optimist, but this is also statistics, right? So if you look at the number of conflicts or wars that are launched today, I mean, there's still pockets of aggression in the world, and I mean, we're actually sitting in one of those pockets, sadly. Yeah. But that's the exception, not the rule. The rule today is, in fact, when you look at the world,
economic cooperation
and peace. So mm-hmm. most neighboring countries are at peace with each other, and breaking that peace brings headlines all over the world. And that was not the case, not even hundreds of years ago, where countries would fight all the time and empires would fight all the time. So peace is also evolving. It's not there yet, but I think it's happening.
It's interesting because I think that over time, those countries that would squabble and fight wars that are neighboring countries, they did so for those specific reasons to you know, conquer and whatever. But we've realized over time that what happens on one side could affect the other side as well. So, for instance, you know, what happened in Iraq, Iran was scared it would happen to them. All these coups that they had in the 20th century. So I think we realize that maybe diplomacy and working together could be better for our each individual in groups,
yeah.
but could also at the same time be a win for everyone.
Yeah, I agree. So that's what they mean with the survival of the friendliest. It's actually, it really did increase our fitness in a way that fighting, you know, just kind of squabbling with each other, that makes us stuck. That kind of stops us from really exploding in knowledge. And think, mm-hmm. I think we're in a really interesting place today. In the world, it's an amazing time to be a woman. It's an amazing time to even to be a poor person. You can get support from your government. You never did in the past. You were poor, you just die, right?
I mean, you're on your own.
Really,
survival of the fittest, for real.
Yeah. So this is, it's interesting if you really want to take it seriously. I think it's quite of an optimistic future. It's true that we're, you know, at the same time destroying our planet and blah, 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 but, you know, put that away for a moment.
It has it coming.
Right. But wait, elephants. Interesting. Elephants.
Elephants. We keep coming back.
Maybe by the end of the episode.
Our fun friend, the pachyderm. Yeah.
We didn't forget, for the listeners, you'll get their answer.
They get there eventually. This is going to be the longest YouTube clip ever.
No, but like, honestly, when people say, oh, we'll come back to that later, and they never do, and you either forget or you're just like,
But what about the elephants?
We'll get there.
No, I'm good. I'm good at keeping tabs open. You should see my Google Chrome. It's
amazing. Oh my gosh, same. And there's nothing more satisfying than Xing them all out when you're done, like your big project or whatever. Yeah. So.
I think I have like a hoarder mentality when it comes to some of these tabs. Actually,
mm-hmm.
So I end up bookmarking them.
So last
before
year,
I closed them out.
Last year, I looked at like with guilt on the 300. Tabs I had bookmarked, God. And I was just like, I think it's time to not. So I just closed them all.
On your phone browser too.
The best thing that can happen is your computer dies, and then for some reason the tabs don't restore, and you're just like, I guess this was just fate.
Yeah,
it's been open for like
it's
9 months.
It's for the best.
Yeah, and it just haunts you, right? It just like keeps looking at you with this guilt.
I never made that pie, and I never will. Let's close the tab.
It's time to come to terms with it. Right. So, all right.
Elephant tab. Now, this theory was really interesting because it talks about language evolution. But so that's how I kind of came across it. I read this kind of self-domestication as a trigger for language evolution. Thought it was really cool, but then I looked at that list of traits, and I was like, cool, yeah, great, but I think elephants also show a bunch of these. I just love elephants. I've always loved
like
them.
How did you decide on elephants and not, you know, a donkey or whatever other animal?
I've always found elephants to be a really fascinating animal. They're very social, they're very royal, they're very peaceful. So elephants are actually one of the most pro-social animals in the animal kingdom. Even when it's quite inspiring. So elephant on elephant like mortality is basically non-existent. It's very rare, and when it happens, it's usually triggered by something like elephant PTSD. So calves that were that saw their mother die, or because of different kind of culling or habitat reduction, had some sort of trauma and didn't get a proper mentor, a matriarch to guide them through, or a bull. So they are acting out, but it looks like PTSD symptoms. And just elephants in the wild, just they're not aggressive. They're not aggressive towards other animals. They're not aggressive among themselves. So male elephants have this thing. It's called mushed. It's must.
Must.
It's when basically their testosterone levels kind of elevate and then they go crazy. And instead of being, and they could be really aggressive when that happens, but instead what happens is that they emit this kind of warning vocalization signal to everybody around them, which effectively says, stay away from me. I can't control what I'm doing.
No kidding.
Yeah. So they don't want to hurt anyone.
They're just saying like, I'm about to let out some aggression. Just give me some space. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So even when they could be aggressive, they really avoid it at any cost. And they're a very social species, and I just always loved them. I think they're beautiful. This has nothing to do with science. This is just for me.
Sure.
But because I love them and I knew kind of a lot of stuff about them, when I looked at that list, I was like, it can't be that it's like only humans and it's elephants. They're also super social. They learn everything. They've got complex communication.
They have a great memory too, right?
They have a great memory. They control their emotions. They have a very long childhood period, for years, where we're like humans. They have to learn everything. So most animals, if you think of a giraffe, you know, like it's out
they,
and
they
within a few
fall
hours
out and they're, you know, that looks tasty tree and just do it.
Yeah, and most animals.
And now I'm a giraffe.
Neat.
Yeah, so most animals indeed just end up being rather independent and learn a lot of their knowledge is innate. And yes, they do have to learn things from their moms and from the environment, but there is a lot of kind of already competence in the newborn. In elephants and also in humans, as you clearly know if you're a parent, we need to teach them everything. We need to protect them and we need to guide them. And that's in the mammalian world also a sign of kind of sophistication or cognitive.
Really?
Well, because if you need to learn things, just, I mean, that means you have to have memory. You need to have some sort of inference. Okay. There's a lot, and it matters where you are. So you need to learn things from your parents. That means you need to have more sophisticated language, perhaps some forms of teaching. So those are kind of signs of culture or signs of complex social cognition. So elephants were really interesting. And then I saw this and I was like, okay, I'm gonna show that this is a thing. And elephants may have also been self-domesticated, because we've never domesticated elephants. Elephants have never been domesticated by humans. So if they show these signs, that must have also been an organic process. In fact, the reason that we know that elephants were never domesticated is because, I mean, you must have seen in movies and whatever,
riding the elephants and
So elephants are taken captive and used by humans in as beast of burden in Asia, definitely. But they don't really reproduce in nature, in captivity. Exactly. So they don't actually. It's very hard to get more than one generation of elephants. So every time you see an elephant in captivity doing something, it's either been taken, or most likely it's been taken from the wild as a calf and raised by humans. Or maybe it's a second generation, but that's it. They don't really reproduce after this. It's impossible to domesticate them because it's a very long multi-generational process. And the reason is very interesting, I think. Most animals know how to parent, right? So most animals, when you look at a dog, it gives birth to some puppies, and the dog just knows what to do. In fact, most animals know what to do when they give birth. Humans are a very interesting example. We do not have an innate knowledge. No. The knowledge of how to parent, of how to be a mother, is culturally transmitted. We have to learn it. We have to see it from our mothers, from our sisters, from books.
And TikTok.
And TikTok, of course.
Take tips from TikTok.
I learn everything after. No.
Right. So learning culturally transmitted knowledge on how to be a parent is very special. And elephants are like us. Elephants need to be exposed. They live in these matriarch groups with like an old female and kind of the daughters and the daughters of the daughters, and the males go about at some point and just like come back. I don't know.
They just go off.
Well, they also have very social, complex social relations within them. We actually only recently discovered.
Within the males.
Yeah. We only recently discovered there used to be this kind of notion that male elephants just kind of wander around and they're very lonely in that sense. They kind of do their own thing, but now we know that's not true. They have coalitions. They also learn.
People think that of human males as well. They do. There was what was that one author who said she lived as a man for a while and found it terribly lonely.
Aww.
She was like, oh, and if this is how men feel all the time, and this and that,
it's because they don't go to the bathroom together.
I guess. No, it's funny because as a man reading that, the thought that kept creeping into my head is like, well, that's your perspective as a woman. You're living as a man outwardly, but you aren't a man from your core. So your reaction to those stimuli are at their core different.
Yeah, I think that's
so. Mm-hmm. Where you might, as a woman, respond with loneliness, a man might not.
Yeah. I think it's
depending on the situation.
Yeah. No, it's a good point. And just the things that you count as, I don't know, kind of friendly gestures could be totally different.
Yeah.
Completely.
Exactly. Yeah. One of the things she said, she's like, you know, like I miss just like getting hugs from my girlfriends, and like guys don't do that. And I'm looking at that, and I'm like, first of all, we do, but like maybe it's not the same. Like it's true.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, a firm handshake or like, you know, like a quick
buy me
pat
a beer
or something. Yeah. Like, yeah, exactly. Our touch emotion and that sort of relationship it's fundamentally different.
Yeah.
And my grandma used to say, men and women are different. Thank God.
Thank you.
Rest in peace, grandma.
Oh, I like that.
She always used to say that, and why is a crooked letter?
Why is a crooked letter?
Oh. Whenever I used to ask why, I think she was just tired of answering my questions. Anyway, go ahead.
Right. So, okay, so what are the, yeah, what are the men, no, what do the bulls do?
Well, this is kind of new science because we didn't have ways to track them. And again, I'm not an elephant researcher, so I'm going to say this kind of to take that. I know.
I thought that's why you came.
I know, I'm sorry. I'm just going to go now. but my point was that elephants also have to learn how to be a parent, and they don't. So when females give birth in captivity, for example, in a zoo, there is quite a high proportion that they unintentionally do something like kind of offspring neglect. They just don't know how to take care of them, and then the calves often die, or the humans need to kind of take care of them instead and kind of step in or teach them. You see in zoos that you can teach the mom what to do. So that is
like good luck teaching an elephant how to elephant as a man.
I know,
but because we're so similar, maybe it works somehow.
I mean, I think
maybe not as well, but
yeah, I think we try. But if we really want to kind of let them be and have this kind of natural process, then it's they need the pack, they need the experience of the matriarch, they need their wise grandma, right?
That's
so
incredible.
Wise and progressive.
Yeah.
So I remember reading in the abstract of one of your pieces that you mentioned bonobos as well. Are self-domesticated.
Yeah, so people felt like, oh, look, humans, they may have also been self-domesticated, and that created kind of this excitement of whether we can find more species that humans didn't domesticate but show this domestication syndrome. That would mean that there are maybe parallel kind of evolutionary stories to us where species became more pro-social on their own merit. So from some sort of, I don't know, external pressures, internal pressures, something in their environment pushed them outside the survival of the fittest and aggressive into kind of more friendly. So bonobos have been also identified as one of these species that could potentially be self-domesticated. But because bonobos and humans are still relatively similar, it's hard to tell if it's a completely different evolutionary process or if we're somehow...
Oh, if our self-domestication happened higher up in the tree? Or...
Probably not. The story for bonobos, it's actually that... at some point, a group of bonobos ended up in this kind of island setting. And so their common ancestors, so chimps and bonobos share a common ancestor. Sure. And the idea is that some bonobos potentially went to this kind of island where they didn't have a lot of predators and there was a lot of food. There was a lot of kind of an abundance of resources. And that meant that rather than selecting for pro-sociality, it was not the case that they needed to be more social, but just the kind of pressure to be aggressive and fight over food and fight predators was just reduced because there was nothing to fight for. So then they just became more social. Yeah. And maybe, by the way, that could also be the case for humans. So it might not be that we became more pro-social because that was beneficial.
But our resources were plentiful enough that we had no reason to fight over it?
For example,
I mean, I guess you see that in like a blackout and in every doomsday movie where it's like, you know, the lights are out, no more power, food is going to be scarce. It's like, you know, immediate riots and looting.
Yeah.
Which ultimately I think is counterproductive. Like, you know, if in that moment everybody instinctively was like, all right, let's band together, let's see what we've got, let's kind of divvy things up, the chance of survival would probably be way higher.
And I mean these kind of buffered environments play a really big role in domestication, so having an environment that's kind of buffered and safe enables more pro-sociality, but often more pro-sociality enables having this sort of more buffered environment. We can take care of our weak, we can take care of other people around us, we can cooperate to make the environment safer. So it's again this kind of ping pong, and this is what we do to domesticated animals, right? We created a buffered environment for them where they're fed, we protect them from predators, and that also kind of boosts this sociality. So it's towards us, so it's a very it's a very interesting thing. So yeah, so humans and bonobos, and now potentially elephants. So the paper came out and we kind of showed with both kind of behavioral and molecular and also genetic evidence that elephants also show a lot of the traits of self-domesticated species. But because elephants and humans split, so the last common ancestor for humans and elephants is the last common ancestor of all placental mammals. That is a very long time ago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so we split.
What is that, the Eutherian, right, or something like that?
I don't think that specific species has ever been identified. So it's a kind of a hypothesized species. Sure. But it's a long, long time ago. And that means that if elephants are also self-domesticated and they also show this kind of, we ended up kind of converging evolution, but that means that it probably happened very differently and completely separated from the path that humans went through. So we can learn a lot from looking at the parallels in evolution between us. So that was the goal of this paper. I really hope that what happens now is that people start seriously investigating elephant communication, because elephants communicate in not just vocally, but also gestures. And they also have this kind of subsonic, we can't hear a lot of elephants' communications, a lot of kind of very, very low frequency rumbles and things that carry out for kilometers in the savannah. So we're now
slow. They can hear each other from kilometers away.
Yeah.
And we can't hear that sound.
No. I mean, we can record that sound and detect it with specific tools. So it's
that's crazy.
I know.
It's really cool.
Yeah. So we don't know.
I'm not surprised by that.
I know, right? Because they're so amazing.
I guess I'm alone here. That's nuts. That's cool. That's so
but
cool.
I feel like it's so fitting of animals to have that kind of stuff. Like, you hear about how dolphins communicate and about, you know, echolocation and all that stuff. It's like
Exactly. So I think we tend to underestimate what other animals can do. It's because we're used to evaluating them on the matrix that we kind of think is.
Like, how come you didn't build a house?
For
like,
example,
you idiot.
For example.
And they're like, "Cause we don't need one, you idiot."
Like, how come you don't speak? And then we're like, "Oh, I guess if you're a bee, you do this kind of dance, and that's that's a lot of information. We don't communicate like that." So
you know what I just thought of? How a cat's meow has changed to appeal more to humans.
They're a very domesticated animal. So
they know how to sound cute to get us to help them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and I know my dog is manipulating me. It still works, but I know he's doing it.
For sure. And that's actually an interesting thing with domestication, is that if you think about it, domestication is about more pro-social behavior towards another species. Yeah. So dogs did not evolve to be more social towards each other. They evolved to be more social and appealing to us. And in fact, dogs are still pretty aggressive between amongst each other, and that's a very different story than the self-domestication story, which is about kind of an within species social behavior. So that's also just something to kind of keep in mind.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Whether this theory is correct or not, I have to say I'm not going to put all my eggs in that basket. So it's as a scientist, you have this appeal to theories that have interesting predictions and that have testable predictions. You can actually go to these species, do some genetic analysis, do some computational modeling, or try to find if this is correct. But I think we're far from it. So I think the self-domestication idea is an interesting one. Not committed to it. It could be that it turns out to be wrong.
Still very, very cool.
Yeah. Very. Are there other animals, you know, because like you said, it kind of hit you bolt of lightning by chance that, elephants kind of fit the bill. Mm-hmm. Are there any other animals since now, since you've kind of invested a lot of thought into this, are there other species that have crossed your path?
Yeah, so we've speculated in the paper already about some of the more social species, for example, whales and dolphins that you mentioned before.
As self-domesticated?
Potentially. So in order to kind of attribute self-domestication to a species, you need to do a lot of work. Not just this kind of list of behavioral and cognitive and molecular things, but also genetic.
But like,
analysis.
But like the hypothesized
right
additions to the group.
So we now have a collaboration with a bunch of other labs working on different animals that are all vocal learners. We thought that would be a very interesting. So vocal learning is this ability to kind of learn and modify new vocalizations based on in the environment and what other species do. It's very common in birds and kind of, you know, songbirds and so on. But actually within primates, we and marmosets are the only vocal learning primate. So other animals, other primates cannot learn to modify their vocalizations, hence this kind of innate kind of universal. Wow. But there are other animals that are vocal learners. Whales are absolutely vocal learners. This is why you see their songs kind of changing as they meet new groups of whales. Dolphins as well, bats as well. You also mentioned bats. And seals. So we are now trying to see whether we can find self-domestication traits in those groups as well, but this is going to take years to find out. So
what do these theories mean for what we consider to be intelligence in a sense? You know, because I know, for example, if I look at the UK, if I'm not mistaken, it was the UK that that said, God, I'm trying to remember. I want to say insects or something like that, where they're, you know, these are intelligent now or something. Like, and it changed legally how certain creatures need to be kept in, you know, that animal abuse laws would extend to them, for example, things like that.
Yeah, I think intelligence is a tricky one, even when it comes to humans, right? So a lot of intelligence tests that we've developed in Western society don't work for other more rural or non-educated communities,
and we don't have like the mirror test, the understanding of self,
which elephants pass.
One of the but few apparently species. Fish as well, and like certain angelfish, all sorts of stuff don't do that. No.
Yeah, I mean we're slowly again we tend to underestimate other animals, and I think as we become more humble and also our tools become more sophisticated, we realize that there are more and more animals that show these kind of markers of social cognition and social intelligence and even tool use, right? So there's elephants definitely use tools. They even make tools. They take these kind of twigs and kind of organize them so they can scratch their backs or clean their ears, hit humans if they're annoying. They throw rocks at electric fences.
Yes. I'm gonna hit you with a stick. Stop it.
Like, do they like hold it up like, you know, like a person would a rolled up newspaper or something? Like back up.
I don't know. Interesting. I mean, I'm sure YouTube is full of videos of that.
I've seen people in Russia cuddling with grizzly bears.
I wouldn't do that.
Yeah, I would find that crazy.
That sounds very dangerous.
It just sounds like a wilderness man doing his thing.
It sounds like the precursor to a really bad movie.
I know. Right.
Who knows if it's real? Well. I mean, I don't believe video footage anymore.
These stories don't end well. They don't have a happy ending, ever.
But anyway, that guy who had a relationship with the lions and they remembered him and like he came back years later.
I cry from that YouTube video. They also put Whitney Houston and, you know, it was just in the background.
That's gonna make you cry. Yeah.
or what's that one song? The sound of an angel or something like that?
Oh my god.
The wings of an angel.
That's what they do for all of the adoption center commercials.
Yeah.
It works on me. Right, but intelligence is a tricky thing because we don't know how to measure intelligence. Yeah. And if you want to go to a different, you know, you want to go to a hunter-gatherer community where maybe they're illiterate and maybe they don't have proper, what we think of as proper education. I mean, they can do things that we can't. They would fail all our intelligence tests, but they're clearly very sophisticated. So it's an intelligent test is a kind of already a biased thing.
Right.
And I think many animals are very, very intelligent in doing the thing that they've evolved to do. So we couldn't fly in a flock, could we? I mean,
but I think the more correct way of referring to this is consciousness, not just intelligence. It's like, okay, we can be intelligent in different ways, but we're like all humans the same level of consciousness. We still have like, we know that another human, even if he's from an indigenous secluded island somewhere in the Amazon, like that
how do you know?
That he has the same emotions, that he can you know become traumatized in the same way that we can, and like
I challenged you by saying how do you know, because the only way we can really know is by observing behavior and projecting if this behavior fits what we would consider what we would do. I mean, you can never know. I mean, I'm the only person that I'm sure. I know I'm conscious. Whether you're conscious, I mean,
it's very Kantian.
Yeah, but we're basing this on behavior and display of action. But if you look at other animals, assuming that this is the only test, if you look at other animals, there is no reason to assume that they're not conscious.
Does an animal know it's being captured? Does it understand what's going on?
Probably to a degree,
I think absolutely.
What's the weight of that? So he doesn't know what could happen to him. in captivity. He doesn't know.
But I think when the sudden shift of environment and fear. Exactly. I mean, that's definitely going to instill some sort of
trauma, anxiety. Fear. You can measure the level of anxiety in their bodies. You can see that a lot of them, some captive animals, they really get depressed. They get symptoms of depression. So if we look at the way animals behave, we look at the way they display emotions, again, fitting to their species. Sure. Mm-hmm. Assuming that they're not conscious, that would be a weird interpretation. So the parsimonious.
No, I just meant like on the level that we are, I guess when people are, when you're sold into slavery, let's say, like, you know what that looks like, I know where I'm going now. In a sense, you understand beforehand, okay.
I don't know. So when colonialism, arrived to Africa and they lived for, very happily and peacefully, when Dutch or British arrived there and took them to slavery, idea what to expect, right?
A lot of the groups within Africa had been enslaving each other for a while as well. That's another can of worms. I think what I'm taking away from this conversation, because unfortunately we do have to wrap it up, but I think I know it's fun and I'm really happy you came. But my big takeaway is my in-group is better than all of the others.
That's horrible.
Except for the elephants. If I could
shape the take-home message that you take.
Please do.
Please. Is that I think our in-group is growing and that it's quite inspiring to see how you can be close and feel empathy and real connection to people you've never met just because they share some things with you. And if anything, your in-group is becoming kind of closer to your heart and also further away from your sight. And that's quite awesome.
All right,
so
that's better than mine, I guess. It's a better takeaway.
Perfect takeaway.
Limor, thank you so much. We've been waiting for this one a while. You traveled further than any of our other guests to be here, all the way from the Max Planck Institute. So thank you again so much for coming.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
I'm so happy about that. And I'm Aaron Porras.
I'm Hannah Rifkin.
And for more actually serious topics, remember again to like, follow, and subscribe to the podcast on Audioversity, YouTube at Aaron Porras, all major podcasting platforms and social media. We love you.
And maybe talk to someone from your out group and see how they're doing.
Mm, yeah. Great message. Yeah.
Don't attack with sticks.
Only if they're annoying.
Only if they're annoying. Just hold it up and threaten.
And a slow rumble.
Actually, serious. Amazing conversations from Israel, all topics considered, with Aaron Porras and Hannah Rifkin.
All our shows and podcasts available online on our website and on all podcast platforms. Search Audioversity.